Hi, everyone, and welcome to today's podcast. I'm Caleb Meath, one of the policy officers at the Council of Deans of Health, and I am joined today by Dr. Gillian Ward, who is the Research and Development Manager at the Royal College of Occupational Therapists, and Professor Sarah Curran, who is Professor of Pediatric Medicine and Rehabilitation at Cardiff Metropolitan University and is Chair of the Research, Development, and Innovation Committee for the Royal College of Podiatry. We are here today for a special podcast as part of the Council's 2022 Research Month, where this year's theme is research capacity and capability. To this end, we have brought together two of the professional body experts in research from two of the professions that the Council represents in order to facilitate a conversation across professional boundaries. To this end, we will start with individual questions and then move towards broader discussion questions. So without further ado, Gillian, I'll bring you in and ask today's first question, which is, what is the state of research in occupational therapy, and what are the current research priorities of the Royal College of Occupational Therapists?
Thank you, Caleb. Thanks for asking me to speak today. It's fantastic to be part of the Research Month and to be talking to you about research. So at the Royal College of Occupational Therapists, we launched our five-year research strategy in 2019. So we're about halfway through that now. And our vision for research is really that within the next decade, we have a UK-wide culture that embraces engaging in and with research as part of every occupational therapist's business, and that this will really become embedded within the profession. We've got a real ongoing need to build the capability, the capacity, and the enthusiasm for research in our profession to ensure that the evidence base underpinning occupational therapy practice continues to expand, and that the next generation is willing and able to contribute to its development. I guess it's also for us about recognising and valuing this spectrum of engagement. So when I said from working actively with the research evidence to participating in the development of the evidence base, and they're not necessarily the same thing, but that there's somewhere on that spectrum of research for everyone, including our learners. I think also the professional culture of occupational therapy in all sectors of health and care across the UK needs to evolve to a position where engaging in and with research is like a matter of professional pride, so of underpinning the quality and the efficacy of the services that we offer to the individuals, the groups, and the communities that we work with. And I think in terms of our research priorities, we completed a James Lind Alliance priority setting partnership in July 2020. So we've just quite recently published our top 10 research priorities that you can read and find out about on our website. And these are quite purposely broad in nature. We were never going to get into prioritising one clinical group above another. So we would never say, for example, working with children and young people is more important than working with older people. I think we might have caused World War III if we had tried to do that. But as I say, they're purposely broad in nature, and they can be applied to any clinical context or any population that an occupational therapist might work with. And so our focus now is really to encourage and support our members to undertake and contribute to research that helps to answer the questions that are set out in the research priorities. And we have funding available through our Royal College to support research that addresses the top 10. And we're also working to influence the opening up of external research funding opportunities that will address the top 10. So we're just at the beginnings, really, of identifying and addressing our current research priorities. That's a quick summary, I think, of where we're at.
Thanks, Gillian. It sounds like sort of early days, but big things ahead is kind of what I'm hearing.
I think so.
Perfect. Thanks again, Gillian. So I'll move over to Sarah, and I'll ask you sort of a similar question and say, what's the state of research in podiatry, and what are the current research priorities of the Royal College of Podiatry?
Okay, afternoon both. So really it's we're in a healthy position, I think, from a podiatry point of view, but we also have a strategic research and development plan, which actually goes similar to Gillian's, but it's from 2018 to 2023, so probably a year ahead. And our mission for this is for the podiatry profession within the UK will have hopefully a strengthened evidence base underpinning its practice, professional knowledge, skills, and the role in healthcare and public health to the benefit of service users and also the population as a whole. Now we have four strategic goals, but whereby we try to identify podiatry and foot and ankle related research priorities. So in the same vein as what occupational therapy have done, we went through a James Lind event, and that was done back I think in 2019. So we've already had our top 10 priorities set. And also we want to build and develop a research culture which really truly enhances our profession to really embed that evidence-based practice in particular. And with that, expand the research capacity and capability of the current and future workforce. So it's by integrating a mentorship scheme. So we've worked quite hard within the committee to create some awards, and they have links to mentorship as well. So it's about obviously mentoring those younger career individuals who are interested in research, but also those who are in clinical practice and they have a taste and a desire to not just do research, but to do innovation as well. And that was something we did when we wrote our strategic plan. We changed our name slightly to include innovation, because I think innovation is a really pivotal word in research, because in order to innovate, you need to research, and it becomes a little bit the central fulcrum of a seesaw, so to speak. And then we want to ensure that the impact of the rise in research is widely disseminated. So it's about us having a greater voice, not just nationally, but globally as well. One thing I do need to mention is we've just had a really significant report, a landmark report published back in November 2021, the SACS report. And that really is a little bit of a crucial feature of our profession, because it's something we're going to be working towards. It's going to be a blueprint, a framework for our profession to work towards. Professor Mike Sachs has wrote the report, hence its name, and he has come up with 28 recommendations, of which the last three recommendations, 26, 27, 28, focus on research. So it's amalgamated with us talking about our research development strategy. We're also going to be identifying the need for more clinical research in particular, which is really public facing and patient identifying those patient benefits of our research, and really getting that evidence-based practice a lot more stronger. And of course, there's that feature of beyond Brexit as well. Funding for everybody is incredibly challenging. And we need to really look towards collaborating with other professions, other AHPs, and also those institutions who are leading on research as well. And recommendation 28 really looks at gathering that systematic data and monitoring and analysing specific clinical and organisational aspects of podiatry to truly inform practice, to embed that evidence-based practice a lot more.
Thanks, Sarah. I think a lot of interesting points there, and some which will go a bit further into depth in just a few minutes coming up. I think at first, I'll go back to one of your earlier points as we sort of broaden the conversation. So I'll bring back Jillian in about how students are involved in research and how it's important to bring people in early to research, sort of cultivate that interest. It's something that the council definitely agrees with, and some of our sort of research reports have shown that importance as well. So I'll just have this question then, which is, what are the best ways to involve students in research?
I think for me, one of the first things you have to do is to help students feel excited about research, and to see it as something which is part of everyday practice and not an add-on if you have time or if you have a special interest. For us, it's really around that kind of fundamental research as part of my practice. Otherwise, how do you know that the services and the intervention that you're providing to the people that you work with is the right intervention, that it's effective? They need to see it as integral to their everyday practice and not something which is done by a few people. And as I was saying earlier, that's not to say that everyone will go on to follow the a kind of dedicated research career path and become, you know, a leading researcher, but everybody needs to be able to understand, to read, to find the research, to understand it and be able to apply it as to their practice. So I think there's a real need to help people to develop their fundamental research skills in those when they're students, and also to give them the confidence to use them, and you know, to make them feel confident, to make them feel that I have a role here, that I can read and understand research, and that it's important for their everyday practice. And one of the ways that we've been doing that is to strengthen our learning and development standards so that there's a link with HEIs and how they can support to get the best outcomes from research. So within our learning and development standards, which looks at the curriculum in our occupational therapy programs, it's around strengthening what the expectations are maybe that students should be looking at to help them to feel confident and to help them to get that excitement. And I think also about helping them to make links, to make connections, to take advantage when they're out in clinical practice, to see research in the real world, and really kind of get that excitement going, you know, so that it's something that they see that they can be part of. Is that okay?
Australian. Really helpful. Sarah, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, we at the Royal College a number of years ago, we wrote a core curriculum, and I was the privilege of being involved in that as well. And part of the core curriculum are guidelines which all the UK and Ireland universities need to link the ones who are delivering the undergraduate degree in podiatry, and research is part of that core curriculum. So, and of course the universities, the HEIs, have that embedded in their curriculum. And I think I completely agree with what Gillian was saying as well. Research is innate in everything we do every day, even beyond our own profession. It's like if you go to look up something to buy online, you look at reviews, you look at stats in terms of reliability, validity of a product. We do it without realizing. And I think it's getting them to engage that research. You should not shy away from it, because it's full of quite big complex words, and it can put some people off. I suppose it's a little bit like biomechanics, really fancy wording, and anatomy is full of long words, and people don't really like it because it's difficult to digest sometimes. But it's about introducing them early on, and I think that's the role of the HEIs in particular, is to gain them, whet their appetite really. To some may go more qualitative, others may go quantitative, and so forth. We have an annual conference every year, and what the RDI have started to do more prominently is invite students to submit their final year project as opposed to presentation. So it's getting them engaging in the process, getting under peer review, and being able to disseminate their findings at national level. So it's about encouraging them as well. We also have the Journal of Foot and Ankle Research as well, which is our journal, along with the Australian Podiatric Association as well. That's our official journal. And it groups significant high hitting research from our profession, and it's really is something we're very proud of as well. So that comes hand in hand, so it demonstrates outputs as well to showcase in particular. There are other ways in which we do engage students as well. We, alongside our research and development innovation committee, we have a member who represents the student network, and we are seeking out to HEIs to gain an update of all or students who are undertaking research. Now, that doesn't have to be just PhD or master's in philosophy. We want to reach out people who are doing their master's research project. So they're doing an MSc, but they're in their dissertation year. I think it's really important to integrate those individuals more, because there is that continuum. Yes, a PhD is integral. I think what is coming across as well as we move forward is that the nature of professional doctorates. We always consider PhDs to be the pinnacle of a level, but I think professional doctorates lends itself to vocational areas such as AHPs. And I think that will be really quite future-facing for us. Yes, I know prof docs have been around since the 1990s, available in the UK at different universities, but they do offer us the change management, and they can really influence change. And I think because of the last 2 years of the pandemic, I think it's changing a lot how we deliver our healthcare. And I think it's a useful way of someone getting their confidence up with research, engaging in research and applying it clinically and working at the same time. And I think employers and industry can actually support in that way, and grow our profession and grow that evidence base, which is what we need.
Thanks, Sarah. Really interesting point on sort of the merits of the PhD versus the professional doctorate. Mm-hmm. Bring it a little bit earlier in the career path. Both of you have talked about how sort of the core curriculum, so to speak, has to involve research. What exactly does that look like in practice for you guys? Is it research placements primarily, or does it look like something else?
For us, I mean, generally it's so the fundamentals, really. It's that research methods, it's getting them into engaging some elements of research. Now, of course, there's going to be disparity amongst universities. Some universities will get those students to do a full project or where they collect data. Others will get them to do a systematic review or a narrative review. Now, the breadth of research is significantly wide, but it's engaging in, and also the critical review writing as well, which is really at level four, at year one. Those are absolutely essential skill set which they build on going through. So it's quite a clear guide, and there is that expectation as well. And I think what is coming through now with many universities, it's often delivered in a multidisciplinary fashion as well. So it's an interprofessional perspective, which again is really important, I think, moving forward. I mentioned earlier about the collaborative nature of gaining funding as well. This silo approach, I think, of our professions, particularly the AHPs, I don't think may not stand us in good stead going forward. We need to blend together to really get that funding, and also so therefore the practitioners, clinicians of the future need to recognise the other professions.
Yeah, I completely agree with that as well. Our learning and development standards are interpreted differently by the different HEIs in terms of the curriculum that they deliver. But before we the last update of our learning development standards, we did a sort of mapping exercise, because our Royal College accredits all of their pre-registration education programs, so we have access to all those accreditation documents, and we were able to map the research curriculum content, and they do vary from university to university. So as you said, Sarah, some universities have an opportunity to collect empirical data and to do data analysis. Others, it's a literature review or a research proposal. The types of assessment vary as well, in terms of, sometimes students will, do a dissertation. Others, they're expected to produce a journal paper, as an output from their research. So it does vary from university to university, but all of them are looking at teaching those fundamental research skills, from literature searching, critical appraisal, which is absolutely key to any area of research, and particularly in integrating research into practice, to find the research, to read it and understand it. If you can't do that, then you can apply it to your practice. So they're real key skills that our higher education higher education institutes are teaching the students. I think research placements are probably very new in terms of undergraduate. We do know of some areas in occupational therapy that are offering research placements now. We offer at the college a research internship. So we have an 8-week research placement opportunity, internship opportunity. So it's for final year students or learners, or up to, I think it's 2 years, just post-qualification, that can come and spend 8 weeks with us in the summer, sort of experiencing what research and development is like at the college, and helping us with some of the research projects. So that's been going now for a couple of years at the Royal College of Occupational Therapists, and that's been a very successful opportunity and has moved from being a real world, 5 days a week in the office, to last year offering that as a virtual internship for the 8 weeks with the changes and ways of working for the pandemic. So it's been really great to be able to offer that.
Thanks, Gillian.
Can I just add there, Cleb, as well? I mean, that there is the research placements as well. We don't necessarily offer it, but there is MSK interns, and this is the Nurse and Allied Health Professionals internship program, which is run has been running for quite a few years now, and it's run every summer. And there are 8 places available. It's currently out to advert at the moment, and all HEIs advise their final year or their recent graduates to apply. But this is an absolutely fantastic opportunity for those who have an interest and appetite for MSK musculoskeletal research, and they get the opportunity to, over the summer period, to go and work at the 1 of 7 of the leading universities based on musculoskeletal and rheumatic disorders. So it could be Southampton, Glasgow, Caledonian, Kiel, Leeds, Oxford, Salford, or the west of England as well. And they really get the opportunity to work in that multidisciplinary team. And it's not necessarily related to podiatry. And this is where the allied health professional and a multidisciplinary working does come in its true capacity, really. And getting feedback from previous interns as well is really positive. They've had a really positive experience. It's helped them being involved in a publication, being able to contribute to writing in a grant. It's also enabled them to get a job in research, and also allowed them to apply for funding for a master's module as well. So it gains them a really good set of skill set and allows them to be part of a multidisciplinary network in musculoskeletal disorders in particular. So that's another example of a research placement, which of course is open to occupational therapy as well, because it's open to AHPs.
Thanks, Sarah. It sounds like it's a smaller section of the undergraduate research sort of world at the moment, but growing. There's new sort of internships placements that are popping up sort of everywhere. I'll move it on to a topic that'll be of interest to a lot of our listeners today from the council membership, and say, how do the professional bodies collaborate with HEIs to achieve the best outcomes in research and to support researchers? Sarah, I know yeah. You sort of work across the two, so can I bring you in first on that?
Yeah, so we work in, sorry, Cleb, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, not a problem. How do the professional bodies collaborate with HEIs to achieve the best outcomes in research and to support researchers?
Okay, so we, as I stated earlier, we have the Research Development and Innovation Committee. Within that committee, we have individuals from academia who are research-based and also involved in education. We also have representation from the NHS and also private practice in particular. So the Research and Development Committee do connect with HEIs by through default of their committee representation. We also have a professoriate as well, which allows that connectivity higher up at that level too. But we're naturally encouraging people to apply for national panel memberships. So we become transparent with that. So there are members of our profession who are linked with REF, with the Research Excellence Framework. We have people from our profession who are on NICE as NICE committees as well. In terms of getting the best outcomes as well, it's about ensuring that we have a transparency in our message. So our research strategy is available online, but it's making sure that we communicate with the HEIs, and by that committee membership, it allows us to remain interconnected really in a frequent manner. I mentioned earlier about our annual conference. That really is an excellent linkage for networking, but also it allows us to bring a community together and also disseminate key findings, and allows those individuals who have key research themes to be presented, and it kind of like becomes a snowball effect as well. I mentioned earlier about the professoriate. And also we have a number of leading centres of research across the UK in podiatry, and they're namely Salford University, Leeds, and also University of Southampton, to name a couple. They are really pinnacle, and they're evolving our research base, and it's that connection, I think, also with the Journal of Foot and Ankle research, which I mentioned earlier. So it's that cultural, and I mentioned about our strategic aim. We have our four main goals, and it's developing that culture, that research culture as well, to inform and enhance the evidence-based practice. In particular, one feature probably I have mentioned the word about the pandemic and COVID. I think what is coming quite clear at the moment is COVID has changed how we deliver our patient care in particular, and it's affected not only podiatry but all healthcare, all allied health professionals. And there's been that connection of the feature of technology, and I think technology is going to change. Was changing, I think, how healthcare was being delivered. But COVID, I think, has the last 2 years has really accelerated that quite significantly. So the Royal College of Podiatry has set up a technology impact group, and it's working with the HEIs, and again, which I'm privileged to be a member of. And this is on the back of the TOPL review, which was published in 2019, and seeing how we can change the delivery of care. Now, there have been a number of papers published in a number of allied health professional topics in relation to consultations and assessment. And funny enough, over the weekend I was reading as you do, but there was comments about telehealth, because podiatry has engaged in telehealth, as I'm sure the other HAPs have as well. But there's going to need to be some global telehealth guidelines. There is an absolute need. This is on the back of a article published in the BMJ Open Journal, and it's a statement done by University of Staffordshire, and they're saying we need to identify some guidelines so that everyone is really singing off the same hymn sheet, I suppose, to make sure that we're not compromising patient safety and care, and making sure that we're using the same terminology as well. So it's about that standardization. So there needs to be that engagement with the professional bodies, with the HEIs, in a multifactorial purpose in particular. So I just think COVID and technology have kind of like is a next step in terms of certainly helping to achieve better outcomes going forward as a research initiative over the next few years.
Thanks, Sarah. I really like that metaphor singing off the same hymn sheet. It sounds like, you know, the question was framed sort of as a binary, these two institutions, but it's really more than that. There's journals, there's, you know, regulators, there's international organizations that are all sort of necessary to keep the gears turning. Gillian, are those sort of similar themes that you guys deal with?
Yeah, very similar structures. We've got a research and development board and a learning and development board, both of which have got academic members on them. And we also link in with something called the Council of Occupational Therapy Education Directors, which allows us to link in directly within each of the occupational therapy programmes within HEIs across the whole UK. So that's a great network to enable us to support, you know, to reach out and have that contact. But, you know, just as Sarah was saying, our annual conference is very important for us. Bringing education, practice and research together, I think, are so important. And I think the profession is stronger and more effective, you know, when you've got education, practice and research working together. So our annual conference is very important in doing that. And some of the other multi-professional networks as well. So for example, we have CAPR, we have the Council for Allied Health Professions Research. So bringing us as a group of allied health professions together to have a stronger voice. And, you know, we will comment on Health Education England policies or proposals which are out and have that stronger AHP voice. So that's really important for us. I think you also asked about supporting researchers themselves. So we offer annual awards, which can be for travel or international activity, continuing professional development, small research awards, so that we're taking those stepping stones. You know, nobody can go from zero to applying for a multi-million pound research grant. You've got to kind of have those little stepping stones along the way. So our annual awards go from sort of 750 up to £5,000. Sort of little small initial, you know, funding pots. And then we also have our research foundation, which has a research priority grant, research career development grants, systematic review grants. So kind of helping people to kind of build that stepping stone to develop their research career pathway. And I think that's really important. The other thing is our, it sounds to me like you're a bit further ahead than we are in terms of our own network. So we're in the process of developing an occupational therapy research network and creating some research champion roles so that those research champions can reach out to support researchers. And we're particularly looking for learners and students and HEIs to get involved in that as well. We're not looking for leading research experts. We're looking for that enthusiasm, that keenness to kind of get involved and help people to, you know, to do research really. So there's some of the other sort of mechanisms that we kind of use to support our researchers as well.
Thanks, Gillian. Some of those stakeholders will be strongly familiar to our listeners today, and hopefully some of them will reach out about sort of developing those networks, as you mentioned. I'll end with our final question for the day, and I'm just going to combine two for you two to know. And I'll say, so what are the main blockers currently for research, and then past that, looking forward, what does the future of research in your professions look like?
I think I'm sure it's the same for you as well, Sarah. I mean, there's just considerable external pressures really on services. And also I think for us, many occupational therapists, I think they hold strong identities first and foremost as practitioners. So they see themselves as, you know, that's their job, that's their role. And many find it challenging initially, I think, to sort of envisage or embrace engaging with research as part of that. And I think that's one of the key cultural things that we need to change, is so that it becomes embedded and accepted as part of everyday practice, not as something additional that you do if you have time or that you have a special interest in research. It's really about normalizing that, those research behaviors. But you know, the overwhelming lack of time, lack of management support, low levels of confidence, the absence of research mentorship and leadership. I mean, these things have been well documented, I think, for AHPs, not just for occupational therapists. And you know, it is a cultural change. You know, we need to, you know, to help people to see themselves and hold that identity of, you know, being a researcher and an occupational therapist or other allied health professional. And I think the kind of lack of clear research pathways and careers is not helping for AHPs, and particularly for clinical academics. It's a real challenge to balance that role in a busy work environment, and to make sure that your research is integral to your everyday work.
I agree with what Gillian has said, that, you know, podiatry does echo that very much. Time and is the absolute blockage, I think, for many individuals, not just working within the public sector, but also within the private sector, because many of our members of the Royal College of Podiatry are indeed work in private practice. And in particular, we actually published a career pathway back in autumn of last year, and I think that's really useful in it, and it gives people a little bit more of a guided framework to work to, and that obviously details research and development is quite key. But for me, it is time. It is about the funding. I mentioned earlier about Brexit as well, and it's about the opportunities for individuals to engage with formal research as well, and not, it's not all about just PhDs, it's about those other levels, other ways of engaging in PhDs. And I think we're going to have to look, we're going to have to be a little bit more smarter in the way we work, and maybe look towards industry more as we move forward, and like I said, to work collectively as well. So we've got to be more mindful of that. But like Gillian has said, it's about engaging in with our membership for us to for them to acknowledge that research is there for everyone when we do it every day, because we need to have the evidence base behind us of what we do, why we do, and why we do it well. That's how we are going to grow as a profession. Both professions in particular are evolving, and they're gaining that evidence base, and it will allow us to have a voice. You know, we both professions are represented at CAPA, as Gillian has said earlier as well. So it is, I think Brexit has nipped us in the rear, I think, a little bit. But I think also, even with the way COVID has been the last couple of years, or almost the last couple of years, there has been some positivity there as well, in that it's forced change, it's forced some change, and it's made us ask more questions probably quicker than we maybe would have anticipated. And I think technology, the top of review is incredibly timely, believe it or not. But also, I just think technology will change things. Digital health is going to create innovations. It's going to create smart wearables. It's going to allow us to engage in maybe patient benefits of the interventions we're giving them, create greater ownership of the delivery of care, what they're giving them as well, and allow us to record it better as well, and allow our systems of data recording to be a lot more collective and much more evidence-based and reliable and valid. Not saying that at the moment, but it's about recording it and ensuring that the evidence is there to support what we do.
Thanks, Sarah. Both of you mentioned the first thing was sort of time and making research a central sort of factor of the profession. Does that go hand in hand with the funding, or is it more about the sort of clinical pressures that COVID have created, and those will sort of hopefully ease over time, or is it a combination of the two or others?
I think it is a combination of the two, really. I mean, yes, you know, in the past, you know, people may have had research funding which has bought out their protected time to enable them to engage in research, but that's not a sustainable model. You know, that's not sustainable to, that's fine if you want to become that research expert and really develop a research career, but that's not every healthcare professional. You know, it's more around how do we embed those research practices as everyday practice rather than having separate funding which buys people's time out to develop their research skills and perhaps do a master's or a doctorate. It's more around reshaping the way that we do things, reshaping the way that we manage our services, to include finding that research evidence as part of the norm in any service, really. And that's really where your service managers set set a lot of the culture and a lot of the agenda in terms of how services are delivered and managed. And you know, it's around in the culture that they create as well in terms of enabling that to happen in the services that they manage. So it's complicated, it's a complex environment. But you know, that I think there are several things that need to change to kind of move it forward. It's not as simple as just giving them time or money. It's around culture, skills, confidence, and embedding all of that in everyday practice. It's not a quick fix overnight, but I think both of our professions are definitely well on that way, you know, with our research strategy and research priorities now. And I really feel, certainly for occupational therapy, that, you know, those research priorities will really help to shape the research that occupational therapists engage in over the next few years. And we're really encouraging our members to contribute to research that helps answer those unanswered questions, you know, to really move our profession forward with its evidence base.
Thanks, Gillian. Sarah, did you have any last comments?
No, I mean, I think, you know, the research agenda is going to be, as Gillian said, it's to foster the new generations of evidence-based clinicians. That is what we're, you know, that's our desire, really. And to make sure that we, like I said, we have a voice with the other health professions. It's interesting, isn't it? Because you said, Caleb, about time and finance and funding, and that will always be there. You know, it's like the cement what needs to connect the bricks to together. But there are also other features of when you build that house, what it needs. So it's an amalgamation of features. It is exciting. It is challenging, though. Every allied health profession are going through significant challenges at the moment. But I think, you know, as certainly from the podiatry profession feels ready for the challenges, and they are well supported, I think, by the Royal College of Podiatry for their members.
Thanks, Sarah. Unfortunately, I'll have to bring today's podcast to a close with that. I'd like to thank Sarah and Gillian for joining me, as well as the audience for listening in. I'd like to remind the audience that there's a host of webinars, podcasts, and blogs, which are ongoing throughout February as part of Research Month. And do sign up or check in on our website if you enjoyed this podcast. Thanks, and enjoy the rest of your day. Bye.